So we're starting a new series of exploration tonight that's going to go on up until Christmas time, and that'll be between me and Nyanavacha and Sila Kriya, and with Padma Vajra's guest coming down as well. And what we're going to talk about is the theme of going for refuge. So I'll kind of introduce what we mean by this term, going for refuge, that you might have heard. As a matter of fact, you will have heard if you've been around the centre for any length of time. But we're going to explore what does it really mean. So hopefully you'll be able to come to all the different evenings. And you can. But each one should stand alone as well. And how it will work is that I'll talk for a bit, and then hopefully there's time for some discussion. So it's a bit like a seminar. Okay, so this is, as I say, by way of introduction, but also starting to present some of the material. So yesterday, and some of you were here, we celebrated Sangha Day. So Sangha means the spiritual community. And Sangha Day is one of the main Buddhist festivals of the year. And the Sangha, the spiritual community, is one of the three jewels, what we call the three jewels of Buddhism. There's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And that's what we've got depicted on our cases, and probably seen symbols of them and heard that term, the three jewels. It's kind of very... it's completely traditional throughout the Buddhist world, not just Sri Ratna. But then it's worth just pondering a moment, even though we've heard this term many times, on what does it mean, and why are they jewels? So, well, they're jewels because jewels in the ordinary world, a jewel is the most precious thing, most sought after thing. I was thinking of two things when I was thinking about jewels. I was thinking of a recent trip to see the crown jewels. When you see those huge diamonds, and the people have kind of died for them, just that something of a very, very sought after thing. But then I also remembered the first watch that I got as a Christmas present. Do people remember when they got their first watch? It always seems such a grown-up thing to get your first watch. And anyway, a tiny, tiny writing on my watch, it said 17 jewels, were inside this watch. And I remember just being amazed to imagine all these diamonds inside my watch. Just the excitement as a little girl of having this watch with 17 jewels. I think they all had that in those days, watches. They all had jewels inside. So jewels in the material world are precious, sought after, rare. And then in the spiritual world, you could even say in the whole of existence, then the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha are the values that are most sought after, most desired, most worthwhile. And you could even say that all other values come from them. All other values are in some way a reflection or a derivation of those highest values. I could go down a whole track on that, but I'll resist it. But I think that's why... we will often feel when we come to the Buddha Center, there's a sort of feeling of rightness to it, because everything is in line, or at least as much as it can be in line with those highest values. So feel right at every level of these three jewels, the highest values. And what Bhante Sangharaksha draws out, he says, well, when we call the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha three jewels, we're considering them in the abstract, as it were. We're considering their value and their relative value. We're saying they're the highest value. But when we speak of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as refuges, then we're considering them in terms of the practical implications of that evaluation, and the fact that those values exist. So, you know, just to elaborate a little bit, the Buddha being the historical Buddha, but also the principle that all human beings can become enlightened, the Dharma being the truth itself, the Sangha being the wider community, but in terms of the Arya Sangha, the fact that other men and women have also got enlightened. So the fact that those values exist in the world gives us the possibility of development and a progress, well, basically beyond what we are now. So if we consider them as refuges, then well, they're representing complete liberation, complete freedom from any of the constraints we feel in our ordinary life. So yes, the three jewels, but then the three refuges. And then we speak of going for refuge, don't we? I mean, again, anyone who's been at the centre for any length of time will have heard this notion of going for refuge. And these words aren't accidental. We don't just accept the refuges. They're not something just to be believed in. There's something to go. There's action. There's going. We go for refuge. So when we say, I go for refuge, we're not just acknowledging the value of the three jewels. We're actually acting on that. I can't remember what it was for all the different religions, but I know Christianity best because I was brought up a Christian. I certainly remember the creed that we said, which was, I believe. So the creed in Christianity is I believe, but if you were to call it creed in Buddhism, you'd say I go. So there's a different interest and difference of emphasis. So this action of going for refuge, it's a reorientation of your life in the direction of the three jewels or refuges. And I think that word orientation is quite interesting. We had, as part of Sangha Day yesterday, and again some of you were there, we had some mitra ceremonies, which we, you know, very commonly have on festival days. So we had some mitra ceremonies, and as usual, all the mitras-to-be, who are now our mitras, wrote a little statement about why they were becoming a mitra. And it all was very, very moving, and I'm always struck by many things that people say in them. And one of the new mitras, she said that in discovering the Dharma and discovering Triratna, she said she'd found practice and values worth orientating her life around. So in a way she's saying exactly what we mean when we talk about going for refuge. You found something that's actually worth orientating your life around. You're only going to do that for something that's worth it. Something has to be worth it to galvanise yourself and to integrate around. So she found practice and values worth orientating her life around. And I think that decision to orientate life around the three jewels was a very big decision. You could even call it a conversion, although I know that word's a bit loaded in a way. But you're transforming your life in this new light of these three jewels. So that is radical in itself. But even that's just the beginning. So in the end, what we're striving towards as Buddhists is to actually become the three jewels. So I particularly wanted us to do the dedication ceremony before the meditation because it really it gives voice to that, this fact that actually we become the three jewels. So in the dedication ceremony, which we've just said, I don't know if you remember, but there's one little section that says, may our, how does it go? May our, that's funny how one's mind goes blank when you try and repeat it. May our mind become Buddha, may our thought become Dharma, may our communication be Sangha. So that's more than just moving towards the three jewels, the three refuges. That's actually becoming them. Amazing thing, really, isn't it? May my mind become Buddha, or may our mind become Buddha, is probably a better way of putting it, because it won't be my mind, as it were. May our mind become Buddha. May our thought become Dharma. May our communication be Sangha. So that's a real radical thing. That's what we're moving towards and going for refuge. So for that to happen, how Bhante describes it is he says that there has to be a shift in the centre of gravity of our being from the conditioned, what's traditionally called the conditioned, to the unconditioned, from what we call samsara to nirvana. I'm just going to pause over those terms for a minute, because again, they're ones that you might hear, and it's easy to misunderstand them. I think when we say moving from the conditioned to the unconditioned, or from samsara to nirvana, it can sound a bit like we're moving from one place to the other, but they're not places, they're modes of being. So we're moving our centre of gravity from being conditioned by greed, hatred and delusion to being free and creative, to being not conditioned by them. We'll come back to that later on in the evening. And then the other way you could say is we're moving from samsara to nirvana. But again, these aren't places. They're ways of being. They're more like verbs. Like we samsarize when we're driven by greed, hatred and delusion. And I guess you could say we nirvanize when we're unconditioned by them. Again, we'll be coming back to them, those notions later in the evening. So we're shifting our centre of gravity. And Bhante uses a metaphor of the wheel and the spiral. Well, it's not original to him, but it's traditional, but he draws it out, the wheel and the spiral, which many of us have come across before, which I'm going to spend a good part of this evening exploring. But I just want to read you something he says in this little book, The Meaning of Conversion. So basically, you know, before we talk about any of this, we always need to go back to the Buddha and the Buddha's enlightenment. So, but the thing is, it's very hard to talk about it. It's very hard to talk about what happened on the night that the Buddha gained enlightenment. In fact, not even a Buddha can really describe it. It is kind of can't be put into words, and in a way that's the main thing one can say about it. Bhante says, we cannot say that it is this or it is that, or even that it is not this or not that, because that would be to limit it. Nor can we say it is this and that. According to the Buddha himself, we cannot even say that it is neither this nor that. So all ways of speaking are sort of confounded, they're transcended. Although it's inexpressible, we can get some hint of it by taking a more indirect view. So looking at, well, what difference did it make to the Buddha's outlook on life? And on existence as a whole, this experience of enlightenment. So what the right back to the sort of early scriptures tell us is that the Buddha saw one overarching principle or truth at work. So he saw that every single thing, the whole range and sweep of existence, from the lowest to the highest, in its depth and its breadth, was subject to what he later on called the law of conditionality. So basically, so that whatever arises anywhere in the universe, from the sort of most gross material, physical level, right up to the most subtle spiritual level, arises in dependence on conditions. And when those conditions cease, the arisen phenomena also ceases. And all things whatsoever are governed by that law of conditionality. I mean, we might be used to it in terms of the laws of physics and biology and so on, but the Buddha went much further than that. So he saw that even feelings and thoughts were governed by that, and even the processes by which he himself became a Buddha were governed by this law of conditionality. And so loads could be said about this, and loads has been said about it, but the particular point which Bhante emphasises again and again, and which I want to talk about tonight, which really is the sort of the basic point to grasp and able to practice Buddhism effectively. I mean, we're so lucky to have Bhante to draw this out, because although this principle that I'm about to say is there in the scriptures, it's not really that apparent. It's not being drawn out by that many teachers. But Bhante really has drawn it out. What the crucial fact is that this conditionality is of two kinds. What he's coined as the cyclical and the spiral. Okay, so that's really important. Conditionality governs everything. It's of two kinds, the cyclical and the spiral. So we're going to spend the rest of the evening, just kind of talking about these metaphors of the cyclical or the wheel and the spiral. So was the sort of cyclical wheel-alike order of conditionality basically is the mode of being that most of us are in most of the time, where we're just going round and round, basically. We're just going round and round, just doing the same thing again and again. And I'm always talking about this at this class, really, haven't I? But I don't think I've quite got into my own sort of brain yet of how deeply ingrained that is, that tendency to go round and round, and how hard it is to stop just going round and round. It can't really be done by sheer willpower, because it's very, very deep, the tendency. But not only that, the more we do it, the more we will do it. And again, I quite like this image of a wheel, because what a wheel does is it cuts deeper and deeper ruts. So the more times we do something, the more likely we are to do it again, the more it just becomes our path of least resistance, doesn't it? We know this, I'm sure. I've sat and meditated the other morning, and I noticed myself that this having some anxieties about all the stuff I had to do before the Christmas retreat. All the things I'd set myself up to do, like I said, oh, the winter fair's coming up and I want to do all this and that for the winter fair, and I'm cooking on a winter retreat. So I was thinking, oh gosh, I have to plan all this and da da da, all these different other teaching things I'm doing. Very, very familiar pattern of thought, quite painful. And then I had a memory of being back as a child, and I realised that and also as a child, I must have been about 11 years old or something, or perhaps younger, and Christmas was coming up, and I similarly was going through all these anxieties about all the tasks I'd set myself to do, all the Christmas presents that I was going to hand make with my own hands, but now I was never going to have time to do it. I thought, God, you haven't changed at all, actually. It's very, very... And I just thought, well, these... It's so deep. And I thought, and I realised I'm not going to... It's so deep, it can't just be done by just sheer I can't just go, right, change now, so that I don't do it anymore. It's very, 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 very deep. And there's an, even in a way, that's a fairly harmless example, but there'll be loads, there'll be a lot like that in our life. I mean, again, I'm sure, do people sort of recognise that? I'm sure I've asked you the question before the class. It's kind of frightening as well. It's frightening. There's a poem I was reading by one of my favourite poets, John Burnside, that kind of gives a bit of a slant on this, going round and round. He's kind of talking about it in terms of a death. So he's writing this poem about his grandmother who's just died. And he says that, I don't know if it's still a tradition, I certainly remember when I was younger it was a tradition in Scotland, he's a Scottish poet, to cover up all the mirrors in the house when somebody had died. Yes, yeah, that's still, people still do that. So he was a little boy and all these mirrors were getting covered up. And he's kind of pondering the meaning of that. Obviously now he's an adult writing. And he says, in the second bit of the poem, he says, "No one explained, and yet I understood how readily the soul might linger on, a far song in the hollow of the roof, a thumbprint on a cup, an old cologne. A mercy then to send them out alone, forgetting what they were, no name, no face. Whatever happens in the life to come, you'd hardly want to drag the self along. My uncle's left that house of mirrors wrapped for weeks, a secret flowering on the glass beneath the veils of blanket, wool and linen. And afterwards, I couldn't bear to look, afraid that I might catch her hurrying back to what she'd always known, an eager ghost, smiling at nothing, coming home untransformed." So, I don't know about you, but I love that. I love it, and I find it sort of, you can feel the sort of fear in it, you know, that fear of that whatever happens, well, there's two things that interest me. Whatever happens in the life to come, you'd hardly want to drag the self along. That's quite a sort of Buddhist notion, which I'll come back to in a minute. But just, I couldn't bear to look, afraid that I might catch her hurrying back to what she'd always known, an eager ghost smiling at nothing, coming home untransformed. So I think that's quite a chilling image of what we can be like. So he's talking about, in a way, a death and then the next life, but actually, the life to come could be from life to life. It can just be our life in the next moment. I mean, we've always got the life to come. And, yeah, are we going to be hurrying back to what we've always known? Probably yes, actually. An eager ghost smiling at nothing. I think that line's quite chilling in a way. There's a sort of vacuousness to it. You know, it's a very, smiling at nothing. It's got that sort of just sense of just this pasted old smile, a bit like I've seen about myself in the tea break. You think you're happy, you know, but actually you haven't really explored the range of what life really could be, you know, so you're settling for less. You know, I think that smiling at nothing, to me, is what a settling for less, coming home untransformed. So that's his fear, you know, when he doesn't want to look in the mirror, in case she comes back, just the same, smiling at nothing. So what Buddhism tells us is that this is the sort of state most of us are in most of the time, constantly circling back on ourselves, sort of closing in on ourselves, sort of tightening the knot of ourselves. It's a bit, you know, I quite like that image of a knot as well. It's another metaphor that, you know, you think you're undoing it, but actually you're just tightening it tighter. Bhante said elsewhere, he says, what we call the ego is the contraction of yourself around a delusion. It's you're functioning as an ego. So the ego isn't a thing. Again, it's not, there's no such thing as the ego. It's a way of being. So he says you're functioning as an ego when you're closed in on yourself, sort of shut off from other people. As we explored last week, the operator in this mode, sort of deluding ourselves that the only way to be happy is by sort of having something, pulling things towards us, or kind of hurting something, pushing things away, it will tighten the knot of yourself, to change the metaphor, because it'll always have diminishing returns. It will never work. It will temporarily work. It will feel like a little bit gratifying, but actually you'll need something more to make you happy the next time. Or you'll feel even more paranoid the next time if you keep pushing stuff away. It can never work. So it's the kind of classic sort of addiction cycle going round and round this wheel. So just to look at it a bit more closely. And again, some of you will be familiar with this model. It's taken from the Tibetan Wheel of Life, but it's just a little bit of it. So you've got in the middle greed, hatred and delusion. So they're the sort of conditioning factors. So while we're sort of driven by greed, hatred and delusion, in any form, I mean, these can be quite gross, but they can also be very, very subtle, greed, hatred and delusion. It's any time when you think you can be happy by drawing something towards you or pushing something away. And then you're under the sway of greed, hatred and delusion. Let's just get around the back of this microphone. So there's this driven by this in the middle, and then traditionally around the rim of the wheel there's different links. It's like different links in a chain. And there's different ones we could enumerate, but I focused on just five or six, where one thing leads to another, and the whole thing leads us to going round and round. So there's no beginning or end, so in a sense you could sort of begin anywhere, but let's take for now as a beginning the six senses. So just the fact that we're alive with a body that's got six senses, so that's the five ordinary senses plus the mind as a sense. Given that, which is a given that we're here, then there'll be that those six senses will come into contact with the world. So that's contact. The Sanskrit word for that is sparsha. That will always produce some sort of feeling, pleasant, painful, or neutral, some sort of sensation, which is called vedana. And that will more than likely result in craving, so we'll want more of the thing that feels pleasant, we'll want to get rid of the thing that feels painful. That'll be very quickly succeeded by grasping, and that'll be succeeded by re-becoming. So that's like kind of the life to come, as it were. We'll define who we then become as a result of that. Yeah? So if every time we, every time we see a chocolate biscuit, we unrestrainedly eat the chocolate biscuit, we'll become somebody who can't stop eating chocolate biscuits. We'll become that type of person. And that works with everything, not just chocolate biscuits. This model is our mind. It's not something sort of superimposed onto our mind or separate from. This is the way our minds work. And I just want to show you another model. Let's see, can I get that to stick? It's okay, it's stuck. Got it, yeah. Yeah, especially
especially prepared earlier.
So I think that one shows, that shows in a bit more detail. It's a different sort of shape. But here you've got what we call the primary reality. So do you remember you had contact followed by Vedana or sensation on the wheel model? And then this other word, samnya, which is labelling. So that's just the reality that we all experience. Again, that's just a given by being, you know, being creatures. What human beings have in particular that distinguishes from animals is vitarka, or intelligent reason, so the ability to be aware. But what we talked a lot about this last week as well, what can all too quickly start to happen is that the vitarka can go into mental proliferation. While it's just at this level, it's a potentially positive thing, but as soon as it goes into mental proliferation of prapancha, which is just all the proliferation of thought, which includes like, you know, why did this happen to me? How come I'm so anxious? Oh my goodness, now I'm anxious about being anxious. Where is this all going on? So all that kind of thing. Do people recognize that from meditation? That's prapancha. So you've got prapancha. Not only that, you've got the underlying tendency of greed, hatred and delusion, which was there in the middle, also feeding into that. That prapancha starts to solidify into view. Yeah, so that starts to solidify into this always happens to me. I knew this was going to happen. Did everybody find themselves saying that? I knew this was going to happen, kind of thing. I have all these different kinds of views. And then out of that comes a second lot of contact. And sensation. There's a secondary reality, but there's kind of contaminated, as it were, by all this. Do you see? But then the horrible thing is then that, you can just kind of see where this is going, isn't it? That then is going to produce another whole lot. So we just kind of get more and more. Our mind just gets more and more kind of, well, contaminated, I think, isn't too, putting too fine a point on it. So we start to get further and further away from the primary reality, which is very simple. This is simple reality. This is just our experience. But we colour it. We let it all be coloured by the underlying greed, hatred and delusion. And then we bring even extra to that by all the prapanchizing and start to create whole kind of world views and whole kind of ideologies, personal but also worldwide, can come out of that, which will then colour the next thing, and there's a sort of infinite sort of regress. That then, you know, you could just keep drawing this and drawing it, and it would fill like the whole room and it would be horrible, you know. So maybe I'll just pause there to see if there's any questions or reflections on what I've said, whether we think this is the nature of mind. So I'm aware I've sort of shown you two models, the wheel of life model, which is going round, and then this one, which I think shows a bit more clearly that the wheel is, yeah, it really is our mind, you know, it's not just something to look at as a diagram, it really is our mind. Have you got any thoughts on that? Does that feel like that is what our minds are like?
Can you explain a bit more about the link between view?
Yeah.
And is it like a contact of the view, like as in when you have contact with a mind object, like something arises in the mind?
Yeah.
So the first primary reality might be from something like external.
Yeah.
And the second one is like in the mind.
And not necessarily. The second one will be can there be how you experience consciousness will depend on the view you have. So your view will colour how you re-experience. Oh, can everybody see? Yeah, I should have said, come over. So your views will start to colour how you experience. So, and views aren't just ideas, it's emotional as well. So if you harden into a view that I'm unlovable, everybody hates me, then what you experience will be coloured. So how you experience the next thing will be coloured by that. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You say it's like an emotional filter.
Yeah, I suppose that's a way of looking at it. Yeah. So, and maybe it's good to remember that view is kind of emotionally based. So if I spend my whole life, which I do, you know, a little bit anyway, going around kind of being irritable, then, let's see how I can put this. Well, things that happen, just an ordinary thing that happens, that somebody else might not experience as painful, I will, because I've already conditioned my mind to receive this in a particular way. And by that point, it's kind of too late to go backwards. You can't. So if we go back to this model. So, up to here is just a given. You can't turn the clock back on though.
Yeah.
How you experience that is conditioned by how you've acted previously. But you're not going to be able to turn the clock back on it. So that's the kind of thing that's kind of a bit, in one sense, scary. I mean, it's not. Oh, there is hope, and I know it. I'm going to sort of explain how, you know, what you can do about it.
Was it the vagal or the feeling of it will be experienced differently? So, for example, if you've recently found out you don't have a horrible disease, for example, or something, and so you've been previously worried about something much more serious, you find out you have. It's just a really bad headache and you're just probably dehydrated.
Yeah.
I'd be quite elated at having a headache. I don't know.
Well, yes, I think that. Yes, although I think.
I'm thinking about how a view is going to experience my.
Although I think there's a more ethical dimension to it, in a way. So. Because it's. It's the previous craving and grasping that will condition how we experience our mind just now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's as simple as that. So how we find our mind just now is because of what we've done previously. And probably for most of us, what we've done previously is quite a lot of craving and grasping. And so that conditions how our new mind, our new self, like the grandmother, the new life, is emerging. But when it emerges, you can't, that's just a given then, because all that's already happened.
Yeah.
Yeah? You can't turn the clock back on that. You can only affect what happens next. Mm. Is that clear? I hope I've explained that clearly enough. Yeah? Is there any remaining?
Is the second diagram a more detailed explanation of the two arrows?
Well, there is a teaching, so possibly, yeah. So yes, this teaching of the two arrows is another teaching where it is actually, because the teaching of the two arrows is that something happens, that's the primary experience, an arrow gets shot at you, but then you start to say, oh, why did this happen to me, blah, blah, blah. So it's like you're shooting another arrow, so that would be the prapancha. But what this is drawing out is that that's not just making things more painful for you in the moment. That is actually conditioning your mind in a very, very unhelpful way. So you can see that it's kind of proliferating this, or if you went back to this diagram, you can see it's deepening the rut of the more likelihood that you'll do that again. So, and I think that's the more serious point. Like, I think we're probably quite au fait with the fact that, you know, while stepping back, or if you see your friend doing it, you think, well, that's a bit of a silly thing to do, you know, to kind of add the second arrow onto your first arrow, because it makes it more painful. But it not only makes it more painful, you're reconditioning your mind to be more, for your consciousness to emerge in a way that will more likely go down certain tracks and cause yourself even more pain. So,
like habitual negative thinking or something. Sorry.
Yeah. Yes. But I think it's helping to understand what we mean by that habitual negative thinking. Because again, I think even saying habitual, you might be in danger of thinking, oh, it's just going round and round on the level. But I think the fact that it's actually deepening the rut, to use that model, or to use this, that it's just getting yourself more and more removed from actual experience. It's just getting yourself in a right mess, basically. Yeah.
I was going to ask about when this originally gets set up.
Yes.
I would imagine, well, certainly let me just speak for me, there are some self-views that got set up very, very early in an attempt to try and understand what was happening.
Yeah.
It ended up in a wrong place.
Yes.
And then it just went round that circle and reinforced that groove until it becomes an identity. Some of these grooves have been there for a almost like it feels like it's in the DNA.
Well, it is. Yeah. It is in the DNA. I mean, traditional Buddhism would say that almost like we don't come into being with these grooves, we come into being because of them. This is what sort of drives our very sort of re-becoming. Yeah. So there's no beginning to them, really. And again, we don't need to try and search for the beginning to them. We just need to stop as quickly as possible. Really, you know, in a sense, because that's all we can do. We can't turn, when we're sort of here with them, we can't turn the clock back on them. But we can start to do something more helpful.
And even if you could turn the clock back and nail down the criteria that set it up in the first place, you'd still have to stop the habit.
Yeah.
But that desire to find out why and trace it back is it's a goose chase.
Well, it is, and maybe it is in a certain way, and it is if you're just trying to find out for the sake of finding out. On the other hand, one can use, I keep flipping between things. So this quality of vitarka or intelligence, that's where this comes in. You can allow that to kind of go into prapancha, which is very unhelpful. Or you can use that to investigate your experience. So I'm not saying that you don't ever investigate your experience. So, for example, I think it can be quite useful to... There's some things that can be useful to trace by. So, for this morning, I noticed I was feeling resentful about something. And I really, really wanted to blame this other person. Because I thought I had been made to do something I didn't want to do. And it was all very well for them swanning off. And how come I was having to do this thing? But then, with the help of a friend, I managed to helpfully unpick when it started, and I managed to pinpoint, there was the moment I lost initiative. That resentment was a clue to the moment I lost initiative. Oh, goodness. I can't just blame them, actually. I was a victim, really. I'd lost, I just kind of lost my intelligence. So that was a helpful turning of the talk or intelligence to my experience. I think, well, how did that happen? Ah, that's fun. Because that means that the next time, hopefully, I'll be a bit quicker off the mark and not lose the initiative, so not then go through the whole cycle of, yeah, resentment. So resentment's a kind of that. You know, I had gone into that view, you know, and it's very emotional. It's when, again, it's, the view is probably a bit of a misnomer in some ways, but it makes it sound like just something you think, but it's very, very emotional, like it's their fault, nobody cares about me, you know, quite a sort of weight in it. So that it can be helpful to unpick that and treat that as a clue. But it wouldn't be. If you, yeah, that's the way to use intelligence, I think, to use vitarka. If you just start thinking about it and think, oh, that always happened to me and it's these people, then that's you're going into prapancha. So there is a definite difference between one and the other, yeah. So what to do? So what to do? Well, in a way, we've started about what to do. So what we can do is, if we go back to this four model, we can use our intelligence to look back on our experience and see that there is a point of freedom here, that we don't have to be driven round and round this wheel. So who knows? I've asked this question in this class before, so don't say if you already know the answer, but I think we're probably going off the film, but never mind. So where's the... So you've got six senses: contact, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming or re-becoming. That's just going round and round and round. But there is another way. There is a way off this wheel of cycle of existence. So who can remember or guess at which point, if these are links of a chain, where's the weak link, basically? Or where's the space between which two can you get off this wheel?
Between fading and
flowing. Between Vedana and craving. Okay. Are there advances on that?
Between becoming and re-becoming?
Between becoming. Actually, that's the one. So becoming and re-becoming is the one thing. So, yeah.
Between craving and grasping?
Between craving and grasping, yeah. Any other suggestions? Okay. Yes, well, Sue Emma was right in the tradition, so she should be. So this is tradition between feeling and craving, where you can come off the wheel and go into a spiral or cyclic mode of existence, okay? So, I mean, a couple of people, I think, said between craving and grasping. Traditionally, this isn't where you come off, but I think what you can do between craving and grasping is you can start to pull it back a little bit. If you don't always, you know, if you don't always kind of respond to the craving by actually grasping, I think... Well, my experience is you will start to attenuate this and you get back to this point of freedom if you keep practicing here. But I'm afraid once you've gone to grasping, all's kind of lost really in terms of this, and you go right round the wheel again, and you, as I say, you sort of deepen that tendency. Let me sit back down again. Sometimes, I'm glad in some ways that no one attempted to get off the wheel before here, because sometimes people try and do that. They kind of think, oh yeah, I know what I'll do. I'll try and get off between, I try and get off a sort of stage early. Actually, I think I've done that wrong, haven't I? It's between contact and feeling. No, it's between feeling and craving. Sometimes people try and get off between contact and feeling, as if that was possible. It's only kind of possible in a pseudo way. The only way you can do that is by sort of a willful repression. And as we know, that's probably never going to work. It might feel like it works, but it isn't any sort of long-term solution. But I think it's worth remembering that you can't get off there, because it can feel a bit tempting to try and do that, and it can even feel quite spiritual to sort of think you can jump off too quickly. So that would be, trying to get off between there would be kind of, oh, I don't know, say you're sitting in the shrine room and somebody's coughing really loudly beside you and you're meditating. Is there any, maybe it's only me who does this, but it goes into a bit of sort of, I'm not annoyed, you know, I'm not annoyed because I'm like so good, you know. So there's a kind of trying to jump into it quickly with the sort of what you think of as spiritual. Do people recognise that? Yeah, oh good, it's not just me. What do you think is going to happen if you keep doing, if you practice that?
Explode.
Yeah, you've got to wonder, you're going to explode, and you mean you see it happening actually. So it's a kind of ascetic approach. It's a kind of like, I'll try and mortify myself and then I'll feel spiritual. So the payoff is you get to feel spiritual, but it's, you'll explode, you won't ever really investigate what's going on in this arena, yeah? What's going on at this arena where there's the point of freedom. If you just allow yourself to go from craving to grasping, it'll the payoff for that is it feels natural, you think, oh yeah, I'm being authentic, da da da. But again, you'll never be in the real, well, sometimes it's called the sort of battleground of the spiritual life, or the real arena of transformation, maybe that's a better way of putting it. Where there's a real potential for the real end of suffering. So all we're doing when we go around that wheel, that Buddhism isn't saying that we're bad for going around that wheel. All we're doing is trying to work out our lives. You know, like I think you said, trying to make sense of it all. So Buddhism isn't saying we're bad for doing that. All Buddhism is saying is that won't work. That won't work. But it offers us something that will work, and by turning towards what will work is what we mean by turning towards the three jewels as refuges. And what it means is staying in that gap between feeling and craving. So really fully experiencing all the sensation and feeling, but not automatically trying to pull something towards us or push away. And meditation is a key way for most people to work with this, because it's in meditation you've got enough space and enough wherewithal to actually know what's going on. I mean, in terms of links of a chain, the tradition that's often used is 1/16th of a finger snap between the time between the sensation arising and the craving. So it's a very short time, in other words. But if we can stay in that gap, then what, with the confidence that there can be another way, that we don't need to be just driven around, if we've got a glimpse of another way of being, then we'll enter onto what we call the spiral mode of being. That's quite different. It's quite different from being on the wheel. So remember I was talking about the ego was that kind of tightening the knot of yourself, what we call the ego. Well, Bantry's also said, he says that the non-ego, operating in a way that's non-egotistical, is the expansion of our being. And it's not just inflation, it's not just that our being gets bigger and bigger. It's a mode of action that doesn't feed or reinforce delusion. So it's an open way of being, a creative way of being. It's infinite, it's infinitely creative. I love that image of a spiral because there's no end to it. It'll keep going kind of round and round and up and kind of bigger and bigger and wider and wider. And so you could say that going for refuge, one way of looking at it, is moving from that cyclical into that spiral. And that's not easy. It's not just replacing one thing for another thing. It's actually trying to have a whole new mode of being. And before I come to this class on a Monday evening, I have my poetry class. I'm always really inspired by some of the things that my poetry teacher says. And so I'll just finish by saying something she says in the hope that it'll give you an idea of what we're talking about. So somebody had written a poem and she was giving feedback, and she was particularly giving feedback on the line breaks of this poem. And she said to the pupil, the student, she said, "I can see you've worked on the line breaks. You know, you've not worked on them. I can see you've worked on them." But she said, you've worked on them just one at a time. You haven't really seen the thing as a whole." But she definitely was saying, that's fine. Well, she didn't say it's fine. It's a good start, a good start. But she said, working in that way, I really like this. She says, it's not objectionable. She said, loads of poems will get published when they're like that. It's not objectionable, but it's inert. She says, it just looks like a tidying up process rather than something actually creative. So I really liked that because I thought that can really apply to our Dharma life. Our Dharma life really isn't about being good. If we just look at our actions one by one and just try and tidy them up a little bit and go, okay, it won't be objectionable. I suppose it's better than being a villain, you know, it's kind of okay. It's not objectionable, but it's inert. And what we're trying to do is, we don't want these. But who wants to live a life that's not objectionable, but inert? You know, we don't want that. We want something much more creative than that, I would suggest. And that means we really are going to have to be in, we'll call it battleground, call it, I don't know what to call it, but this gap between feeling and craving. We're going to have to be attuned enough to ourselves to not allow ourselves to run off with prapancha, to not just grasp things towards them or push them away automatically, but have enough awareness to notice there is a gap and have enough courage to stay in it, which will feel uncomfortable because it won't feel familiar. That wheel just feels totally familiar to us, even though we kind of know in our heart of hearts it's not satisfying. It will feel very familiar. It will be very, very tempting because it will be the path of least resistance. When we stay in that gap, we'll be staying in a completely open space where we don't really know what's going to happen. By definition, it's something new. I was teaching the introductory meditation last Wednesday night, and one young man said, I came to meditation to stop all this proliferation of thought. But then it stopped, and then I thought, well, give me the thoughts back quick, you know, because it wasn't familiar to him. He didn't know what to do with the space, so he very quickly wanted, you know, he was bemused by himself, because although in a sense he had what he wanted, he realised, oh God, that's a bit scary, you know. So that's what we have to be prepared to do. So sorry, I've gone 3 minutes over time, but I hope those modules, some of them will be familiar to you, make sense to you, and I hope that is a little taster of one way to talk about going for refuge, and then we're going to have more each week to sort of unpack this term. So yes, turn on from the wheel, from the cyclic to the spiral. sort of task to upset for this evening.